This is an ABC podcast.
Time for the science show. But what's this?
Oh, look at this one. One of the big forest centipedes. Bit too bitey for me to take.
The late Harry Butler in the wild, always finding something under a stone or behind a bush. And now there's a Harry Butler Institute in the West. Hello, Robin Williams, with a science show packed with fossils and a wonderful way to have school kids plant trees scientifically. And Carl Smith introduces a German paleontologist who's in love with a jawbone. And so to Murdoch University and that new institute, meet Deputy Vice Chancellor Professor Simon McCurdy. Simon, where did the institute come from?
It came from many years of having grown up on Harry, of having had the benefit of spending time with him and seeing what he had achieved in looking after the environment and protecting biodiversity. And after he died, in discussions, we just felt it was imperative to set up an institute that recognised Harry for what he had achieved and would also become a long-term legacy for him.
Many of us watched in the wild over many years, and we loved the way he did it. Behind every rock there was a creature. And there were all sorts of rumours about that. But how many people these days remember his name?
You're right, it's a generational thing. I too grew up on Harry. And I think if we talk to people of our generations, Harry is still a well-known name. But we see that as one of our challenges with this institute, is to raise Harry's recognition and raise recognition of what Harry stood for, coexistence of human development and biodiversity. And we'd hope that over the years we'll train the next 10,000 Harrys.
He brought a completely different sort of non-Attenborough approach to exploring the wild, and it was a direct way and sort of thing you could emulate whilst taking precautions just in case that rock did have a snake you didn't expect behind it. But he also advised those exploiting the natural history situation, the islands and so on, and advised them on how to maintain the biodiversity. How well did you think he did that?
I think he made an amazing achievement. I doubt we could find someone else in Australia who's achieved what Harry achieved over his career. If you look at some of the islands off this coast that he looked after and had a lot of input to, they're the best kept islands possibly in Australia. They still have the same biodiversity that was there probably 8,000 years ago. Very limited numbers of invasive species. And you feel the island, you know there's biodiversity around you.
Where does his expertise come from?
I think it was in Harry's DNA. You talk to his family about he grew up, you know, the north, and he spent time with Aboriginal communities. He spent time in the ground, learning what the environment was around him. And I think that just moved through his career, and he just had that real affiliation with the environment.
He once told me that he thought the Australian Aboriginal people are the best natural historians in the world. And I thought, well, that was a casual statement. I actually recorded that, and he had no hesitation saying it again. I was most impressed.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I've heard from his family, and I'd heard that in a few of the discussions I had with him in his final years. He had a real appreciation for what our Indigenous people knew and understood about the environment around us.
What is the job of the Institute?
It's to continue the mantra of Harry about how important biodiversity is for us. But also it's about training the next generation.
Yeah, but also what about the new centre you've got building behind us here?
So a key part of that is building a new Harry Butler Centre, a building that's about bringing the community onto campus to learn and appreciate what can be achieved if we develop areas and be very conscious about how we need to protect the environment and how we can achieve great outcomes for biodiversity.
And finally, how's the corporate world looking at ways of dealing with science rather more straightforwardly than perhaps in the early part of Harry's days?
I think there's a big change on. I think industry are very much understanding that they need to change, they need to be actively working to protect the biodiversity environment around them while they develop a resource or develop a new piece of land. And achieving that coexistence is going to be critical to their future success.
Of course, you can't do business when there's chaos going on, can you? But congratulations, thank you.
Thank you.
Isn't he beautiful? tough little babies.
They're only little, but they've got some mighty sharp teeth.
This might hurt a little bit, fella.
Harry Butler in the wild, and before him Deputy Vice Chancellor Simon McCurdy, who leads the Institute at Murdoch. And so to an example of their work, galvanising young people in the West and nationally, this is Dr. Greg Hoopland, who's leading kids in planting pocket urban forests.
So I've planted 5 school forests and 2 forests in the community. I've got 7 forests out there now. And now we're just watching them grow. And we've got another 4 forests going in this year, plus 3 experimental forests at Murdoch University.
How big are they?
Most of the forests are 100 metres squared, but I've got one that's 200 metres squared out of Brookton in the Wheat Belt.
And which sort of trees do you put there?
A huge assortment. The Miyawaki forests are really different from traditional reforestation in that you plant a whole group of different plants that are locally native to the area. So most of the forests have around at least 27 different species, and some of them have up to 35.
I see. And do they augment each other? In other words, do they depend on each other to some extent?
Well, these are species that have evolved together over thousands of years. So you're planting what would have been there if the area hadn't been cleared. So these plants have evolved together, and there's obviously some mutual dependence, and they actually grow better in combination with each other than if you plant non-Indigenous versus Indigenous. Yeah.
Well, of course, with trees, they take a long time to grow, and you're starting from scratch. So what do you have to do to get them up more or less simultaneously?
Well, the really important part of the Miyawaki method is you have to do intensive soil remediation. So often when you're planting these forests, you're planting them in urban areas, and the urban soil is heavily degraded. So the bacterial fungal ratio is often very skewed towards the bacterial component, and you obviously need the higher fungal ratio for effective plant growth. So I put in a lot of compost, which I develop with the children at the schools that I work with, and we have a compost system that we put lots of food scraps in from their lunch and recess, and then we develop that over a number of months. And then that compost all goes into the soil before we plant the forest, along with coconut coir to help retain the water. Because obviously in Perth, we have very, very sandy soil, so water retention is a real problem. And then we mix all that up to a depth of between 50 centimetres and 1 metre, and that creates optimal conditions for the plants to grow. And then when you put your plants in, very quickly the plants are off and racing. And if you compare the plants inside the forest with the plants that are control plants outside the forest, you can see a marked difference in the growth both inside versus outside.
Schools are dominated by rules, and of course parents don't know quite what you're doing, and you've got to talk to all the different ones. How do you get past those kind of restrictions, and do children just join in naturally and happily?
Children are the best. I think children nowadays feel quite disempowered by the enormity of the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis. They feel like they can't make a difference. If you bring these forests into schools, the children are actually planting the forest themselves, and the empowerment, that, you know, sense of achievement they feel is enormous. You can actually see them really enjoying the whole process of putting the plants in. And then when we come back to do the monitoring every month, which we do as part of the program, you can see they're so impressed with how quickly the plants are growing. And then after a year, some of the plants are actually taller than the children who planted them, which is really exciting for them and very exciting for me as well.
And teachers don't complain about the fact that you're interfering with the curriculum?
No, the teachers love it. They get really involved. I have teachers coming out doing the weeding with the kids, helping to measure, you know, getting really involved with the forest. I think the really lovely thing about these forests is they have a huge capacity to engage people. And it's not only the school that gets engaged, it's also the wider community. Because when we go out to gather our compost, we also go out to local supermarkets and coffee shops and gather all their food waste. We bring that back to the school to add to the compost system. And the people in the community are contributing those scraps, asking what's happening with the compost, have you put the forest in yet, how's it growing? So it's like becomes a real invested process with the community. It's lovely.
I remember doing a story about the value of urban trees and how they can lower the temperature by 5°C. And here in the West, sometimes you get temperatures of what, 32, 38, 40, 42,
yep.
And bringing it down 5 degrees can save lives.
Yeah.
Apart from anything else, making the towns habitable. So have you had any objection from, you know, the value of real estate and all the rest of it, the arguments about space for cities?
Oh, not at all. The beautiful thing about Miyawaki forests is they can fit in basically any unused piece of land. So you can actually plant a forest that's only, you know, 20 metres squared. And if you have a disused car park, you can actually turn that into a forest. So the forests can be very small and they can be upwards to, you know, 700 metres squared, which is one of my colleagues in Queensland's planting a big Miyawaki forest. So, and some in UK are huge. They've done really big ones there.
Colleagues in Queensland, what about the rest of Australia? Who's slacking?
I don't think anyone's really slacking. I just don't think the Miyawaki method has really caught on hugely yet. I know Earthwatch Australia, I'm working with them, and they're planting some Miyawaki forests on the east coast. My colleague in Queensland's planted 11 Miyawaki forests so far, and there's even one little one in Tasmania as well. And there's also some microforests, which is slightly different from the Miyawaki forest, but they're in Canberra, and there's a lady there who's doing them there, so that's awesome.
Have you left your seagrass work behind?
Oh, I don't think I can ever really leave seagrass behind, but for now I am not doing seagrass work, but yeah, it'd be nice to go back to it one day, I think.
Force of Nature, Dr. Greg Hoopland, with the Miyawaki Forest Program at Murdoch University. And the difference that soil preparation makes to tree growth is stunning. More from the Harry Butler Institute in the Science Show in coming weeks. But now our first fossil, and I don't mean Dr. Paul Willis, who's dubbed me as one. Paul, once of Catalyst, now at Flinders University, showing me, well, tell me, Paul Willis, what is in that little case?
This is really exciting, Robin, and it follows on from the last time we had a chat a couple of years ago when we said that we'd secured a small opalised dinosaur in Lightning Ridge. The trouble is, in the intervening couple of years, we've had COVID, we've had financial problems, and that has prevented us from going over to Lightning Ridge to pick this thing up so that we can study it. Well, that all changed earlier this year when we were able to travel over to Lightning Ridge and pick up the specimen and bring it back here to Adelaide. And what it consists of is 71 small lumps of rock with opalised bone in them. And what I'm about to show you is a small sample of those 71 pieces, some of which we've been CT scanning, and then we've managed to print out what the bone looks like before we've even taken it out of the rock.
Is it one bone long broken up of one creature?
Yeah, so far as I can work out, we've got the back end of a small hypsilophodontid dinosaur. It appears to be semi-articulated, so the bones are roughly laid out as the animal died, but there seems to be some movement, maybe by water currents or scavengers on the carcass or whatever. But all up, what is there seems to be beautifully preserved. Unfortunately, we don't have the head, and the head is the bit that will tell us what its relations are.
And when you take the opal off, of course, each hammer blow reduces the value of the whole thing if you are selling it on the market?
Well, it's a really tricky proposition. If it's an opal fossil, then it's covered by what's called the Prevention of Movable Cultural Heritage Act, which means that you cannot take it out of the country without a permit, and there's no way you get a permit for a good opalised fossil. So an opal miner comes across an opalised fossil in his mine, and he can't sell it on the world market. But he can sell the opal itself. So the only way that he can, or she, can make a return on their mining investment is to break it up and sell it off as opal, in which case we lose the fossil forever. So we're trying to work on some ingenious ways around this so that we do get to have a permanent record of these fossils.
Let me see some of the parts. Yeah. He's opening it and they're about something like 16, 50, little, yeah, 15 boxes?
15, 16 bits in here. And if you look at this one, you can clearly see that the opal is forming a small vertebra. So here's the vertebral centrum, and here's the neural arch with the neural spines coming off. So not much of this specimen looks like this at the moment. This isn't going to take much preparation. There's little bits of rock that need to be carved off here and here so that we can see what it's like. Most of what we've got are things like this. There is a hint of there being some bone inside, but other than that, it's just a small rounded lump of sandstone.
And you have to know what you're looking at, as you do.
Yeah. In fact, on this specimen, if you do look at this opalized surface very closely, you can see the small dots they're the trabeculae, the little honeycomb pores inside the bone. That tells you that this is an opalized bone. But we can't say what because it's still embedded in the rock. But thanks to the wonder of modern science, Flinders University has recently set up a CT scanner deliberately dedicated to research to do things like look inside bits of rock like this and see what the bones look like. So this specimen has already gone through that process. And you can see that there is a bit of bone in this lump of rock. But again, you can't say much about it because there is so much rock around it. But we've CT scanned this one and we've managed to reconstruct from the CD slices the virtual copy of what that bone looks like. And then we can take that and we can print out a 3D print of that bone. So this is actually that bone inside that rock. And you can see this surface here matches that surface there. So this is another vertebral centrum. And these parallel lines, that's where the neural arch sutured on to the centrum. So straight away, one of the things this tells us is that it was still a semi-juvenile, because if it was any older, then the neural arch would have fused to the centrum more fully and it wouldn't have come off like that.
Let me ask you a very unfair question.
Oh.
There are people around Australia like Scott Hucknall who've got huge skeletons of dinosaurs. And there are all sorts of grown-up ones. What's special about yours that makes you take so much trouble to get it released?
Well, this is one of the joys of paleontology. Every fossil is like a Christmas present that takes you years to unwrap. We don't know how important this specimen is. It could be a new species, it might not. We might not even be able to tell if it's a new species or what species of dinosaur it is. But Lightning Ridge is the only place in the world where you get dinosaurs preserved in opal. We do get marine reptiles preserved elsewhere. Cooperpedia andamooka, Cooperpedia is where Eric, the opalized plesiosaur, came from. But it's always that sheer wonder. We don't know what we've got. That's what keeps driving us on. Now, really what the miner is interested in is the opal value. But as paleontologists, we couldn't care if they were made of 24 karat gold. What's important to us is the overall shape. So perhaps if we can build up the trust of the miners and say, look, when you find a fossil, before you do anything with it, let us take it down to Tonsley, let us CT scan it, and then we can tell you what you've got and you can do with it what you want, because we will have a permanent 3D record of what that specimen is. And look, if it is the next Eric, then, you know, we can go out there and talk nicely to someone with lots of money, if you're listening, and maybe they can step forward and these things can be preserved as fossils for Australia's posterity. I mean, I was only in the Australian Museum just yesterday in Sydney, and there's Eric in prime position in the museum in their new gallery that they call, what, the 200 masterpieces of the museum. And
you helped excavate it, and you were, what, 12 when I saw you do it?
Well, yeah, I was pubescent, I think. But it was a while ago, but, yeah, I did all the work on Eric, pulling him together and cleaning up the rock.
Plesiosaur, and in fact, as you mentioned just now, Tonsley, is that the area that used to be a car factory, which is now the innovation centre for Flinders?
Yes, and apparently it's really going great guns. There's a lot of startups working out of Tonsley in all sorts of areas of research and technology, and that's where this CT unit has been set up.
Fabulous, thank you. And I can't have one of those to take home, can I? No.
I'd love to say yes, but no, unfortunately no.
Meanie, Professor Paul Willis at Flinders University in Adelaide. Hear the passion he and his fellow paleos feel for their precious fossils? Well, Carl Smith has found the same in this, his third venture to a strange frontier. Carl.
In the basement of a boring-looking university building, Christina fell in love.
And the first time I met him, I was like, oh, wow, yeah.
She actually wasn't sure if he was a man or a woman initially, but she was instantly head over heels.
Oh, he is so beautiful.
They would go on to have a wonderful relationship, spending years gazing at one another, travelling the world, working as a team. And even though they've eventually parted ways, they're still close.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a friend of mine, I have to say.
But the object of Christina's affection isn't human. Despite the way she talks about him, he isn't even alive. Because he is a 610,000-year-old mandible, a lower jawbone.
I fell in love, I have to admit.
You fell in love with the jawbone?
Yeah!
Hey, this is Strange Frontiers, a short series taking you to a handful of unusual, off-limits corners of the Earth to meet the scientists who work there. And today, a vault in Germany with a single key and the curator slash guardian who fell in love with the jawbone inside. It's early spring in Heidelberg. It's quite a cold day. Some of the first green buds have started popping up. And I'm outside a nondescript concrete and brick building in the middle of the campus of the University of Heidelberg, one of the oldest universities in the world. And I'm here with Christina Eck. Tell me why we're here.
Yeah, I'm a paleontologist and I was the curator here in this institute. And we're here to meet the Heidelberg mandible.
So let's first get to know the two of them. Dr. Eck is warm and quick to laugh. She's got big blue eyes and sandy blonde hair. Her first love was dinosaurs before she fell for early human fossils. The lower jawbone comes from a member of the Homo heidelbergensis species. He likely spent a lot of his time hunting, gathering, warding off ancient beasts, and he appears to have had a pretty active, sometimes dangerous life, hundreds of thousands of years ago beside the Neckar River. He was the first evidence scientists found of his species. And at the time, that led to Homo heidelbergensis becoming just the third species of early humans to be classified.
The mandible was found more than 100 years ago near Heidelberg. And the scientist who gave him the name thought, okay, he was found near Heidelberg, so he called him Homo heidelbergensis. And it's only the third ancient human fossil we ever found. So it's very important for paleontology.
Just a handful of bones belonging to this ancient human species have been found. And this one is the so-called holotype, or type specimen, the first example identified and used to formally describe this species. Which is why it needs an official protector and minder. Up until recently, that was Dr. Eck.
Yeah, I had to keep the lower jaw safe.
You see, for scientists, this jawbone is essentially priceless. It holds countless clues about our origin story and our early human rivals. So, alongside a designated guardian, it also has its own special vault, hidden deep in the bowels of a museum here at the University of Heidelberg's Institute of Geosciences.
We're now entering the museum. And we see here a lot of glass cases with stones from the region here of Heidelberg. We have here some tusks of elephants. We have fossils. And of course, we have here a little exhibition about human evolution.
There's information about wooden spears, crude shelters, the giant beasts that lived here half a million years ago. But alongside the objects on display, there's also a carefully catalogued archive hidden away from the public. We leave the main exhibition area through a side door and make our way past the first security check.
We will pass now the first door.
The building might not look very spectacular from the outside, but many of the fossils and artifacts here are locked up under high security.
And now we are standing in front of door three. And in this room is the collection house of the institute. The collection is more than 200 years old. And in this collection are stored a lot of fossils and stones from all over the world.
From the threshold, I can see rows of sealed, floor-to-ceiling storage cupboards. Inside, it's musty. There's not much natural light. And it's dead quiet.
And yeah, there are a lot of fossils, trilobites, ammonites, stones.
And I believe within this room, there is another room. And within that room, there is a vault.
Exactly. And this is the safe for the Homo heidelbergensis. He has his own room because he's so famous and unique. And yeah, there's a little room without any windows and a safe.
From here on in, you need a special set of keys. And remarkably, only one set of these exists, and only a curator is allowed to use them. The anteroom that contains the mandible's vault has stacks of neatly arranged animal fossils dating back to roughly the same time. In the middle of this space is an old-fashioned safe box.
A very old safe, and it's a really dark room because it should be safe from the UV light.
And describe what the safe looks like.
Yeah, the safe is really small, really thick walls, and there's only one key.
But we can't tell you anything more about it, and I'm not even allowed to see how she opens it, in case word gets out, presumably to ancient artifact cat burglars. A special safe behind many locked doors and a dedicated guardian might seem like overkill for an old bone. But when this fossil was found, it led to a shake-up of our evolutionary tree. It's a big deal.
It was only the third ancient human which was found. So we knew Homo neanderthalensis and Homo erectus at this time. And when the lower joint mauer was found, it was the first evidence for humans here in Heidelberg, ancient humans. And because of that, he's so famous and unique.
Despite this, you might not have heard of this species, Homo heidelbergensis. I hadn't until I visited Heidelberg. But it turns out this ancient species played a crucial role in our origin story.
It's important because he's a link between the Homo erectus and the Homo neanderthalensis, and the Homo sapiens emerged from Homo heidelbergensis. So we had Homo heidelbergensis in Africa and in Europe, and the European Homo heidelbergensis is the ancestor of the Homo neanderthalensis, and the African Homo heidelbergensis is the ancestor of the Homo sapiens, so of us.
And in case that's a few too many early humans all at once, let's recap. Homo erectus is believed to be the first species of early humans to leave Africa, spreading first into Eurasia. Then there were a few forays, with their descendants leaving these regions in different directions. One was Homo heidelbergensis. The current theory is that some Homo heidelbergensis in Europe became the first Neanderthals, and another population of them further south around Africa may have spawned the first Homo sapiens, though there's still plenty of debate around the exact sequence of events. Regardless, the take-home is Homo heidelbergensis was a big, recent player in the origin of modern humans. And without rare fragments of bone like this mandible, researchers wouldn't have been able to piece together this complicated story.
They are really, really rare. And you have to imagine that every human fossil is stored like that. So I could put all human fossils which were found all over the world in my car. There are not so many.
So what's it like being a mandible's bodyguard? And how did these two grow so close? Well, they spent a lot of time together. And as curator, Dr. Eck encouraged him to get out of the vault and into the world to meet new people.
It was my task not to let all the people into this room, of course. But sometimes I did guiding tours for school classes, for example. I put the lower jaw in the museum to show it to the people because I think it's very important that people can see him because he's a heritage of everybody.
And you refer to this jawbone as him. Did you become personally invested in his story and maybe started to think of him as someone who you could interact with?
Absolutely. Yeah. He's a friend of mine, I have to say. I have a relationship with this mandible, I have to admit, yeah.
It's possible that he is actually a she, which we'll hear more about shortly. But Dr. Eck thought the jawbone needed some pronoun beyond it, as their relationship deepened.
For example, when I did the exhibition in Mauer 2007, and I was standing beside the glass case where the lower jaw was housed, and I was there every day for hours, and I had to tell people every 10 minutes the story of the Homo heidelbergensis. And of course, I had dreams at night about this mandible. And one nightmare, I have to say, was I went into this room with the glass case, with the mandible, and it was gone. And this was so horrible.
I can imagine when you're charged with being the person who looks after it, you would have nightmares that it would go missing.
Absolutely.
It was intense experiences like this, while travelling together, that formed their strong bond. And it also eventually split them apart. When Dr. Eck felt she needed a bit more space to focus on a new job, communicating science to children. Today is a kind of reunion for them, after a bit of time apart. At this point, I give them a bit of space. Well, actually, I have to leave the collections room and wait outside while she opens his private vault. Then, after a moment, waiting at the edge of the musty room with remarkable trinkets all around, Dr. Eck emerges with a shiny silver case.
This is a special suitcase. It was made for the mandible to transport it. So it's a metal suitcase, key locked, with numbers, and it's really secure.
So it looks like a villain-style case full of cash with the numbers on the side of it. And then what's inside?
Yeah, inside is the mandible of Moa. No cash. But that's much better than cash.
I'm a bit disappointed to see the suitcase isn't locked to her arm with handcuffs, but she is extremely cautious while transporting it. There's even a special bespoke trolley to wheel the suitcase around. And travelling around like this, the mandible inside has clocked up a lot of miles over the years.
Yeah, he was in New York in the 90s, for example. Yeah, he travelled a lot.
We make our way up to a room in the upper levels of the building, somewhere we can open up the case and check out the fossil inside. We arrive, settle in, put on some gloves, and Dr. Eck opens up the silver suitcase with a code and a couple of keys.
I'm open it. So here we can see a black box with black boxes.
Yeah, some cushions to make sure that it doesn't get bounced around in there.
Exactly, and some plastic for the same reason. And now we can see for the first time.
As she lifts the mandible out of the suitcase in gloved hands, she's really moved.
Yeah, and here it is. Oh, he's so beautiful.
To me, it looks like a regular human jawbone, just a bit brownish with age. But someone who's lovingly studied every inch of him over many years picks out plenty of other important differences.
I see a very, very large mandible. It's much bigger than ours. 14 teeth. Because two are lost. They got lost during the Second World War. So when the lower jaw was found in 1907, he was complete. He had all teeth. And during the Second World War, the scientists were a little bit worried something could happen to him in Heidelberg. And he was stored in a salt mine. And after the Second World War, when they wanted to bring him back to Heidelberg, he was in a suitcase in the salt mine. And the suitcase was empty, and the lower jaw was gone. Yeah, they found him on a garbage hill, and since then, two teeth are missing.
Wow. Yeah. Perhaps the main difference that I can see with a very untrained eye is that the bone looks a bit thicker.
Yeah, that's true. It's much more robust than our lower jaw. The ankles are more robust, and the whole jaw is so thick. I think it's twice as thick than ours.
The jawbone is also smooth and rounded at the front. It doesn't come to a bony point in the center like ours.
He lacks a chin because it's an ancient human. Only we modern humans, Homo sapiens, have this little bone here in front of our mouth. And he's broken in the middle of this non-chin. He was broken already when he was found.
And the teeth look roughly similar in size to a normal human's teeth today.
Yeah, but they are bigger. They are twice bigger than ours.
These might all sound like minor differences to human remains, but careful analysis of even small fragments like this is enough to piece together a picture of an ancient species.
For us paleontologists, this is okay, because we rarely find more than one bone, a whole skeleton, that's a dream. Yeah? And there are ancient humans which are only based on a tooth, for example. So to base a species on a mandible, such a complete mandible, beautiful mandible, that's okay for us.
Since this fossil was found, plenty of other Homo heidelbergensis remnants have been unearthed too, showing that this lesser known species got around quite a bit.
Yeah, there were more bones found in Africa, in Spain, in Greece, France, Italy, Germany as well, Hungary, for example. So yeah, there are a lot of findings in Europe.
And these fossils have filled in some more gaps about our mysterious cousin. a smaller forehead, a fairly big brain, a robust frame, and Homo heidelbergensis appears to have been pretty tall too, on par with modern humans. For me, old bones like this, often just fragments, can be a bit underwhelming. After all this build-up, hearing about the vault and the security and how emotionally invested Dr. Eck is, at the end of the day, it is just a brownish chunk of old jawbone, not so different from ours. But the joy and mystique and wonder of archaeology or paleontology is unlocking the stories hidden within these ancient remnants. This is what makes these objects priceless, and it's why people dedicate their whole careers to them. So what else can this fossil tell us? Not just about this species or this individual, but about us. Well, let's start with the story of how and where it was found.
He was found in a sand pit in Mauer. Nobody was searching for fossils at this point. They were just scraping the sand for building houses, for example. And because it's so long ago, more than 100 years, they didn't have any TNT, for example. So they found a lot of fossils during work because they did everything only with their hands. And they found bones of elephants, lions, hippos, deers, pigs.
A local professor of anthropology, Otto Schuttensack, heard about these animal fossils coming out of the sandpit. At the time, there was a lot of debate and controversy and excitement about other early human remains. Scientific consensus was just settling on how Neanderthals fit into the picture after a flurry of fossil finds. So Schuttensack rushed out to the sand pit.
And he told the sand workers, maybe when they find elephants' bones, we can find human bones too.
He showed them what to look for and told the sand shovelers to call right away if they spotted anything.
One day, at the 21st October of 1907, Daniel Hartmann, a sand worker, said, oh, I have found something. I think it's an ancient human. And yeah, they called Schuttensack, of course, and Schuttensack went to Mauer within the next day and took the bone and said, yes, that's a mandible of an ancient human. And he was so super happy.
And because the bone was taken immediately to Heidelberg, poor little Mauer got a bit snubbed.
That's true. The real name should be Homo Maueriensis, yes. But I think Schuttensack thought that, yeah, okay, Mauer is a really little village. Nobody knows Mauer. And Heidelberg is so famous and it's so close to Mauer. So his decision was to call it Homo Heidelbergensis and not Homo Maueriensis.
Thankfully, it wasn't just the anthropology professor who got all the glory. The sand shoveler, Daniel Hartmann, also got a very German shout out as well.
He got a little box with sausages and wine. He got a lot of money from Schuttensack for this fossil. And he was made the honored citizen of Mauer. And today a street is named after him.
So that's the story of this mandible's discovery. But there are more stories hidden in this old bone, including clues about its original owner. Various dating techniques have been used to figure out this Homo heidelbergensis lived about 610,000 years ago. And scientists have been able to piece together even more about this early human and their life.
We know a lot because we have his teeth. Teeth are very important. They tell a lot of stories. We know that he or she, I have to say, because we don't know if he was a she or a he, he was between 20 and 30 years old when he died. That sounds very young, but for an ancient human, that is okay. He has his wisdom teeth. He used them, so we can conclude that he was in the end of his 20s.
And how might he have died?
The sand where the lower jaw was found is by the River Neckar. So today there is no River Neckar in Mauer, but 600,000 years ago there was. And maybe the man drowned and the rest of the body decayed and the first thing he lost was his mandible.
Some later analysis also indicates he had a rough life and that he may have had companions.
He had a fracture in his jaw, visible on the CT scans. And somebody hit him from down there.
From under the chin.
Yeah, exactly. Or he fell. It's healed, so we know that other Homo heidelbergensis maybe took care of him.
Do you ever think about what this Homo heidelbergensis person 600,000 years ago might have done in an average day? I've read, for example, that they had shelters, they used tools.
Yeah, we also found some tools of the Homo heidelbergensis in Mauer, and they were hunting animals. We found bones of deers and horses, so these were the animals he ate. Maybe he lived in a little family, yeah, maybe with a wife or a husband, we don't know, and children, I think. Maybe wandering around, they were following the animals to get some food. They collected fruits and nuts in the woods and made some spears. Yeah, I think it's a nice life to sit around the fire and have a nice time.
I mean, I think there was probably a lot of death and murder in there too, but I see what she's getting at. Now, as with basically all early human research, there's always debate, competing claims, and unproven theories. And some in this field believe Homo heidelbergensis is actually a subspecies of Homo erectus, those early ancestors that first made their way out of Africa.
Still today, some anthropologists say, oh no, that's not Homo heidelbergensis, it's not an own species. Yeah, there's a lot of debate going on.
And unfortunately, genome sequencing, which would be a smoking gun to prove this one way or another, has been difficult with older fossils like this mandible.
People are still working on this mandible, so the science is not complete. It's never complete. Yeah? New methods make it possible to get new results. And our dream, of course, would be to make a DNA analysis here too. That would be great. But he's maybe too old at the moment for our methods.
Until they can find a way to sequence any remaining fragments of DNA in specimens like this, Homo heidelbergensis's exact place amidst the complicated evolutionary tree of early hominins will remain unclear. And that's one of the reasons why a specialist like Dr. Eck is appointed to safeguard the mandible. Someone who knows how to work with precious specimens that might still have more secrets waiting for scientists to discover in the future.
First of all, I have to wear gloves because it's not allowed to touch him with hands because you can contaminate it. Yeah, and nobody wants that. And one day they do a DNA analysis and they find my DNA. That's not funny. And nobody can touch it. So it would be a nightmare if anything happens to this fossil.
We put the jawbone away now that we've had a good look at it. And Dr. Eck says her farewells. It's kind of touching. She misses hanging out with her old partner. And it's clear that she still thinks about him a lot.
Long time ago. Yeah, so I don't have any direct contact to him because I'm not at this institute anymore. But I work for the Homo heidelbergensis Club in Mauer. We are doing guiding tours for schools, for example. And so I still have the opportunity to tell my story.
What sort of reflections have you had about the role of this fossilized lower jawbone in your life?
Yeah, that's a funny question because I have to admit my first love are dinosaurs. And ancient humans for me always, no, I don't like them, I don't need them. So, and then I get to this institute and yeah, with this bone. And the first time I met him, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, that's also beautiful, not just dinosaur bones. And so I get more and more into this topic and yeah, and now I felt in love, I have to admit.
Now, really, Christina Eck's story about what it's like being the curator and guardian of this ancient jawbone could have ended here. You've heard about why this mandible is such an important find in the context of human evolution, and their love story is a fun motif. But I think it's important to point out that for Dr. Eck, she isn't really joking when she talks about her emotional bond with this fossil. After we finished our interview and the mandible went back into the vault, I asked if she'd take me for a drive up the river to where it, or he, was found.
There's the village Mauer in front of us.
Yeah, it looks like quite a stereotypical German town.
The sand pit is over there.
And while we were driving, I got my first glimpse of how an old fossil kind of connects her to our deeper history. Spending time with the fossil makes her think about how her life compares to his.
Yeah, I often think about that, and I always come to the conclusion that we are not able to live like that. We forget a lot of things we should know when we are living with nature.
She parks the car and we walk down the main street of Mauer and out behind the shopping centre, into a gully in the woods. It's a bit misty and there are birds singing, trees with fresh green buds, all signalling the start of spring.
We are standing now in the sandpit Grafenrain, where the mandible of the Homo heidelbergensis was found.
And so when you stand here, does it make you think about the life of the Homo heidelbergensis person who lived here?
Yeah, absolutely. You can catch the mood here. Yeah, so you don't see here any buildings. You normally don't see here any cars. And it was really the same. So he had the same four seasons we have today. Maybe the winters were a little bit more warmer than our winters today, but I have to say in the last 10 years, our winters are getting warmer too. Everybody knows why.
She tries to picture what it would have been like roaming these woods in small bands. She imagines the kinds of animals they would have bumped into based on the fossils found here.
It's a mixture of Africa and Europe today, so it's really funny for us to imagine that there were deers and elephants at the same time in the forest.
And for Dr. Christina Eck, my guide for today, this all makes her think about what's changed, what's been lost, what impact humans have had on the world, and what we can learn from our ancient ancestors to make our own lives better, or to make sure we don't spoil things for future generations over the next 600,000 years.
Yeah, because it's also important if we think about our future and what we are doing right now on this planet. And for example, if the Homo heidelbergensis had nuclear plants, we would have still today the garbage of him. This is something we have to think about, really. Yeah.
Carl Smith and another strange frontier in next week's Science Show, where we end with a living fossil, like me, but one beloved in Australia, the echidna, one of the two remarkable egg-laying mammals we still have, showing intriguing adaptations. How do these echidnas manage to thrive all over this vast continent, keep cool in the tropics and much more? Christine Cooper is a senior lecturer at Curtin University.
We did some lab work several years ago that suggested that when they got hot, they would blow bubbles through their nose. And we hypothesized that that might be related to evaporative cooling. Then we had an opportunity to study them in the field using thermal imaging and to attest to see whether their nose really was cool due to that evaporative cooling.
Hadn't it been discussed before?
People had thought for a long time that echidnas were very intolerant of high temperatures, but they live all over the Australian continent. And there's been some data that suggests that they're really not as intolerant as people suspected, but we needed to explore how they might deal with those temperatures. And so the lab work we did showed that they could increase their evaporative heat loss when they got hot, but we needed to look at the mechanisms. And so this was part of looking at those mechanisms.
We do the same sort of thing because we've got nice, almost hairless skins, and we can sweat. So they're doing the same thing on the same principle, but blowing bubbles.
Yes, it's the same idea. They don't have sweat glands, so they can't sweat like we do, but they can increase the permeability of their skin to water vapour. And the evaporative window that we found is another way that they can increase their evaporation. So they blow mucus bubbles from the tip of their snout, and they've got a big blood sinus that sits underneath the skin at the tip of the snout. So that wets that area as the water evaporates. It cools it, and that cools the blood.
So you put them in a cold environment and they stop doing that, do they?
No, they don't, because they need to have a moist nose for electroreception. So they use electroreception to find their prey and they keep their nose moist to do that. So they always tend to have a moist nose, but they can use that as well to keep cool, and they seem to make it more moist when they're hot. So they can use it two ways.
They're lovely noses, and we've got a couple of echidnas that occasionally turn up every few months in the back garden, and you see little nostrils coming through. And it's quite delightful. But what's been the reaction to your colleagues? What do they say?
They are sort of interested in the idea. I mean, the idea of an evaporative window is not new. So kangaroos do it, storks do it, vultures do it.
Is there only one species of echidna?
There's one species, but several subspecies.
And do they all do it?
Depending where they live, their requirements for heat dissipation are going to vary. So echidna in Tasmania is going to have a lot less requirement for heat dissipation than the echidna in our wheat belt.
So they're in every part of Australia, are they?
They're the most widespread mammal in Australia, terrestrial mammal in Australia. They're found all over the continent.
And they've been around for such a huge amount of time.
Yes, so monotremes and therian mammals, so the marsupials and placentals, diverge maybe about 200 million years ago. But then within that group, the echidnas are more recent lineage breaking off the monotreme group. But monotremes and placentals, marsupials, are a really ancient divergence. And yes, they're found in New Guinea and Australia, and that's it. And they probably have a southern derivation.
And presumably, knowing so much about them, would you guess that for the monotremes, which includes the platypus, there's lots and lots more to know?
Oh, yes, definitely. For most wildlife, there's a lot more that we need to know, and certainly the monotremes. And they're difficult to work on. And we're really lucky here in that we have a study site where the echidnas are really abundant and really accessible. We can go out there and find them really easily, but they're generally quite difficult to find and quite cryptic. But short-beaked echidnas are the best studied of our monotremes because they're accessible.
And when you finish with them, you put them back?
Yes, well, these ones, we didn't even have to disturb them, so we were able to film them remotely. So it was really exciting to be able to do some work looking at what echidnas do when they're out and about foraging on their own without being disturbed. So that was sort of the exciting part of some of this new thermal imaging technology, is you don't have to interfere with the animals.
One of the people you know of is Mike Archer, who has suggested that native animals will make wonderful pets. Do you know anyone who's kept an echidna as a pet?
Not that they've kept them as a pet. They're tricky to feed. They are found in some zoos, and we've kept them in captivity for research purposes. We had echidnas here for almost 2 years. So if you've got the right diet and the right enclosures, you can keep them. And they're wonderful. Ants used to follow us around like puppy dogs.
And you mustn't run out of ants to feed them.
No, we feed them an artificial diet, because that is one of the real challenges with feeding any termitivorous animal, is getting enough food for them. So we fed them artificial food and supplemented it with termites that we could get, because you can't get enough to feed them. They're eating over 20,000 individual termites a day. So,
you say that finally they're great to be with and they follow you around. Why do they do that?
Oh, the ones we had in captivity, they would follow us around for their food. They knew when we were going in that we're going to feed them. In the wild, they're really variable in personality. And echidna personality is another really interesting area. Some are really timid and quiet, and the minute they hear you, they'll just hunker down and not move around at all. Others will come up and sniff your foot. So they're really quite variable, and that's a really interesting idea to look at, is why we get this variation in personality.
We found one in the backyard on a step, and it didn't want to move, and so I thought, well, it might be in jeopardy on that step, someone might trip across. And I tried to lift it up, and it wasn't a question of heaviness. Somehow the feet were gripping or sucking onto the surface. He was immovable.
They're incredibly strong. They are really hard to pick up in the field, especially if they can get hold of some surface irregularity, like tree roots or rocks, and dig in underneath them. And they're really spiky as well. So a thick pair of welding gloves, and yeah, you have to use a fair bit of muscle to pick them up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Christine Cooper is at Curtin University in Perth, loving those echidnas, bubbles and all. A paper just published. Next week on The Science Show, Carl goes to Estonia, but worry not, you're not paying. And I try unboiling an egg. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. And this is The Other Carl. Briefly, I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.